What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating.
I got a big heart, and I'm very forgiving, but like, don't abuse it. It's been abused enough.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, Anna.
Hi, Shireen. How are you?
I'm good. This is Ethnically Ambiguous. Wow, what a episode we had today. It was therapy. It was therapy.
I agree. We have a great guest. You might know him from his podcast, Soul Bomb, which you don't, go listen to it right now. You might know him from Love, Simon. You might know him from My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. You might know him, like me, from Sing Off. So we have the great, the wonderful Clark Moore with us today. You may have just heard him on Las Culturistas as well, so get excited.
Yeah.
It's a great discussion, so stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pets? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow. What a sunny, beautiful day. It feels like summer today to me.
It's hot.
It must be hotter
there
where you are because you're in the valley.
Yeah, it's hot.
Yeah, it's a hot one. I was outside for a literal 5 minutes moving my car for street cleaning, and I was sweaty.
I was like, our first summer wearing masks outside. And then I was like, wait, no, we did it last summer too. What am I talking about? Because I was like a little sweaty in my mask while I was walking my dog. And then I was like, wait, no, I've like the
Well, according to my mom, 2020 doesn't count. She like sent me a thing on my birthday being like only like, it was like a, from 2019. We did like a family thing for my birthday. And she was like, a year ago today. And I was like, Mama, that's 2 years ago. She's like, I don't count 2020.
It is weird. I don't recall. Like, the 2020 and then, like, the beginning of 2021 is all, like, one big blur to me. I have no sense of last year or this year. It's just all, like, during the pandemic. It's all just the pandemic at this point.
Yeah. The pandemic, as Naomi would say. I'm pretty sure she calls it. Was that Naomi? Did Naomi coin that? I don't remember.
Pandemic. Yeah, it sounds familiar.
But today, we are joined by a lovely guest.
Yes.
There's like a certain like echelon of people that I'm just like, they're on our show. And I feel like this person's like in that thing where just like, they're on TV, they're all this other stuff. And I'm just like, they know about us. These are the little people.
I understand. It is surreal when people are like, can I do your podcast? And you're like, like literally. Guys, that's how we react. Anyone who actually really wants to do our podcast, we're like, what?
I mean, you could be anybody.
We have no sense of ourselves at all.
No, not at all. But especially this guest, I'm really excited to get to know him better. You know him a little bit more than I do. He's an actor. He's a podcaster. And he's all around just, I want to talk about this speech he gave. So I consider him like an activist, but I guess we all have to be on by default. But it's Clark Moore. Hello.
Hi. What a lovely intro. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, now, honored.
We met 2 weeks ago about because you guested on Las Culturistas, which I produce with Bowen and Matt. And, you know, luckily, you know, every once in a while I get to snake a guest or two from there, you know?
Yeah.
Honestly, we feel the same. After doing that episode, I was Googling and we're at a point with the podcast where we're growing and we're, you know, aggressively networking. I'm showing up places and in people's ears left and right.
Yeah.
And we saw your name. And this is what I was alluding to before we started recording. We saw your name, like producer. Okay, yeah, I remember she told me to send my audio. I remember she told me, you know. And then I saw your same name over here on Ethnically Ambiguous, a podcast, as I mentioned, that I've listened to before, off and on, truly, for these past few years. And I was like, wait, certainly they can't be the same person. So yeah, you certainly feel like you snaked me. We feel like we being me and my producer, we feel like I snaked my way onto the show. So the feeling is mutual.
It's funny because Hosnier, the most common last name. It's such a silly. It's like the Smith of Iran, you know?
Yeah.
But that's I mean, I feel like I hold that a lot with the people where they'll be like, wait, also of Ethnically Ambiguous? And I'd be like, yeah, I do also host podcasts, but then I also have to produce the shows as well because this is my job.
Yeah.
So I'm just here all day.
The hardest working woman in podcasting.
Thank you
truly,
so much.
I feel like it's safe to say like 60% of podcasts that you probably listen to or like that exist.
60%. I don't know about that.
Bring out the data.
You at least have a toe in a bunch of things. It's not that you fall. I mean, like, you're the podcast queen. I bow down.
Thank you.
But I mean, I'm amazed that you've listened to the show at all, Clark. I will try to believe you as we continue this conversation.
The humility is great.
Yeah. We are so down on ourselves. We're like, what podcast are you talking about?
It's not even humility. It's like very deep self-deprecation that maybe goes too far. Like, I do that all the time on the show, and our listeners would be like, is she okay? Right. And I'm like, no, but, you know.
Edging into delusion. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so thank you for joining us. Now, if our listeners, people may have seen you on the film Love, Simon, which I did. And then actually that was when I realized, I was like, wait, that's Clark from Love, Simon. Like, you know, like, wow, like I don't know how you guys connected with Matt and Bowen. I'm assuming you guys knew each other before that.
Through the internet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We didn't. I mean, Bowen and I had spoken on my show. I interviewed Bowen. He was one of our first three episodes. And Matt and I had sort of DM'd back and forth through, you know, but we were just sort of like internet friends.
Yeah.
And that was my first long form conversation with Matt. And I guess my second with Bowen.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And your show is called Soul Bomb.
Yes. Soul Bomb.
So you guys, you know, go check that out.
Yeah.
Please.
That's B-A-L-M, because I can't say that word without it sounding like bomb, like a bomb. So I like both titles, to be honest.
I know. And we kind of live in the in-between. I refer to our listeners as the bomb squad.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of like That's leaning funny. Into that bomb.
That's the only bomb play. Squad I want to be a part of.
Same.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think that like, bringing people on the podcast is genuinely just a way to like, one, get to know them better, but two, like have a conversation.
Yeah.
So I feel you. It's,
We need an audience to connect. We're broken people.
I know. I mean, even regular conversations now, I'm like, should I be recording this? Is our conversations just like podcasts I don't record? I don't know anymore, man.
Same.
Yeah.
Also, you were on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. You were on which, you know, funnily enough, I don't even know if that's a word. You were on The Sing-Off as well.
I was.
Back in the day, which I did watch.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because I was really into a cappella growing up because I find it very fascinating of like how. How do they know? I spent so much of my life trying to understand how harmonizing works, but there is a science to it.
It's mostly smoke and mirrors, I'll say, with a cappella. We kind of lean on that wonder and we make use of that space. That's our sweet spot.
I mean, it's amazing. We had a really great, I don't know if you remember this, Shereen, we had a really great a cappella group at UC Davis.
Yeah, my friend was a part of it. Yeah.
Oh, really?
One of my best friends. Yeah. There was an all-girl one that she was a part of, and she, like, there was a co-ed one, but I was a fan of the Spokes.
The Spokes. The all-girl one was amazing, actually. Yeah. Because then they also, every once in a while, would, like, beatbox. Like, it was, like, surreal. Yeah. I'd be like, whoa.
Mercy? Is that her? The girl that did beatboxing was Mercy. I knew all of them through Julie, my friend. Yeah. She went to my high school. She ended up being the president of the Spokes by her senior year. She's epic.
Wow.
She did like musical theater and stuff, but they were really, really good.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. A cappella is amazing. But yeah, so I did watch that, but I didn't make the connection until later. And then I was like, maybe I'll go back and see if I can spot Clark.
You can see me. I'm very visible in all of those videos, for better or for worse.
I gotta go back and watch and tell my cats.
I met him.
But so let's go back a little. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm a Southern Belle. I'm a Georgia peach.
Oh, yeah.
I spent, the majority of my life there. And I didn't really, before college, and I didn't really go a ton of places. I mean, we went on vacations and, like, you know, my mom was a dentist, so is a dentist. So she would take us to dental conferences, and those were always in the most random places, like Jamaica or Bahamas or on a cruise. Yeah.
Those sounds like just vacations.
I know, truly.
Like great places.
I think that's the idea, is they're like, we're going to have to be doing boring stuff. We might as well be doing it. And then you can step outside and be in the Caribbean. So we traveled a bit, but mostly, you know, spending time in Atlanta, in Georgia. That's where all my friends were, as my whole life was, until I went off to New Hampshire to go to Dartmouth. And that's when the world kind of cracked open for me. And I've been like bouncing around ever since, although I've been based in LA for the past 8-ish years.
Yeah. How was New Hampshire as like a scene, especially around Dartmouth?
I wouldn't use the word scene in any context to describe New Hampshire. I really loved it. I mean, part of why I chose to go to Dartmouth was that I knew, Atlanta is a big city, even though it's not like a New York or an LA. It feels very metropolitan. And so I knew I wasn't a country girl. You know, I wasn't going to be living in a small town probably ever again in my life, and certainly not in like that kind of concentrated way. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, why not go to the woods? And because it's so isolated, I mean, it's hard to imagine, but even to this day, cell service isn't great there.
Wow.
And there's Wi-Fi that connects the campus, but you know, if you're not in a building, if you're outside, if you're walking around campus, it's not great. And data plans aren't great either. And so it sort of has this like separation from time feeling, you know, it's kind of trapped in, or I shouldn't say trapped, that's a pejorative. It's like preserved in perpetually kind of like the 80s, 90s kind of vibe. And so there's a timelessness to it that's really beautiful and magical. And it taught me a lot about being present, you know, you can't really be worried about it, like texting with friends. You do it, but you can't be reliant on it. You're kind of like out of pocket generally while you're there. And then you run into people and, you know, I mean, some of this is just what college is, I guess, but, but it was the beautiful time where, I got to kind of like figure out who I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. In a really like safe and contained way. And I look back on that time with such great nostalgia.
Oh, did you know going into college what you wanted to study? Like after high school and stuff, was it kind of already formed and you were like, you knew who you were in that regard or?
No, and that's partially why I chose liberal arts, because my parents were very supportive of me as a creative and as an actor, but they definitely were not. They were like, you cannot go to conservatory. You know, you cannot study this. You need to study something else. And so I got there and I was kind of like looking around and being like, what is useful? You know, like what job? I want to be an actor. I want to work in the arts. Like, but they've already told me I can't study theater. I'm not going to study film and television either. Like, what can I do? And so I was looking around. I studied history. I ended up doing history and art history.
Oh, I did art history too.
Did you really? What was your concentration?
It was a minor. I did a minor in art history. I wasn't allowed to study art or film. And so I chose the most broad major I could think of, which was communication at the time.
Right.
And then I ended up like doing enough film classes to double major in film. And then I minored in art history because I just like didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Right. And I, you know, like with schools like Dartmouth, you know, you don't have to declare your major until somewhere in your sophomore year. I don't know the exact term, but by that point, you've already been in school for 2 years. You know, you like kind of know who you are, what you want to do in theory. Mm-hmm. So my freshman year, I was taking government classes. I studied Russian and studied abroad in Russia, which was an experience.
I love that. Oh, yeah. I love Russian and Russia. And I went there once and I've been obsessed about going back ever since. I love that you studied Russian. Well, why did you study Russian? I want to know.
I think I had this idea that, in that practicality sense, I was kind of like floating ideas with my parents and kind of gauging like which of these feels acceptable to you, you know, like which of these feels useful or whatever. And I like floated philosophy and they were like, huh? I floated art history and they were like, hell no.
Huh.
And I mentioned something about like, I think they had this idea that I would be a really great diplomat, you know, that I could, which LOL, obviously I'm gay. And also fast forward, like a significant percentage of the diplomat world of the ambassadors and those people are gay. You know, it's like, doesn't surprise me that the people whose job, their primary job is to throw parties and like smooth things over. Like, of course, those are queer people.
Yeah. Well, you put it that way. Yeah, that makes complete sense.
Right.
I thought you were going to say something like they have empathy and stuff, but you were just like, oh, that makes sense.
No. It's all about like be like smiling and being like, look over here. And, you know, like, are you good at party talk? Are you good? Right. Are you fun to be around? You know, like, will you decorate the embassy in a way that's interesting? And so I was like, you know, I'll study Russian and government and I'll go off and I'll be an ambassador to Russia or an Eastern European country or like one of the Scandinavian countries. And my parents were like, great. That sounds like a really doable thing. And it sounds like something that is impressive and that we can brag about and that we can sort of wrap our heads around. And then, LOL, I took a government class my freshman fall and did not do well at all. And I was like, this is not the field for me. Certainly not in terms of studying.
Yeah.
But then I fell in love with Russia and have become a bit of a Slavophile. It's this weird place. I had a teacher in high school who sort of turned me on to Russia. He was my Spanish teacher, but he spoke Spanish, French, Italian, Russian, and maybe another language as well. And so I always kind of had this dream of being a polyglot. And he said to me, the thing about Russia is that when you're there, you want to be anywhere else. It's so hard. The lifestyle is like, it can be really grating living there. But as soon as your plane takes off, as soon as you leave, there's no place you'd rather be.
Wow.
And I wouldn't say no place I'd rather be, but I will say ever since leaving, I've just been dying to get back and figure out a way.
Yeah. What is that feeling? I don't know. Where were you? I kind of stayed up in Moscow and like the surrounding forests around Moscow. Mm. Where were you?
We were in St. Petersburg.
Oh, yeah, I didn't have time to take the train up there. And that's what I want to go to St. Petersburg, take the train up and down if I can.
Yeah, we took the train overnight from St. Petersburg to Moscow and like slept in the train car and everything. And then only did, I have the reverse experience. We only spent like 3 days in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And St. Petersburg is, it's like, I don't know the number now, but it was something like a couple million, maybe 3 or 4 million people. So it's like it's a city. It's a big city, but it's not, Moscow is something like 18 million or 20 or something crazy like that. It feels very provincial, the thought process and it can feel very small town. And there's certainly more They're known for being intellectual and erudite because of the university, but and because of the history of the writers and the great poets and the artists and the architecture. But the culture can be a little bit more on the conservative-leaning side.
Mm-hmm.
And there were not a ton of Black people, as you can imagine.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Right.
In the months that I lived there, it got to the point where we started waving at each other in the subway, in the metro, because that's how few of us there were. But then I went to Moscow, and it was like, there were all kinds of people from all over the world everywhere, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was much less. People weren't staring at me as much. People weren't... They were used to seeing people of color. And I will say, everyone thought I was... No one assumed I was American. Everyone assumed I was French or, like, from some African country. And that was really interesting. But, yeah, I loved it.
That's interesting. They don't... They're like, an American? Why would an American... One of that's a French.
Well, I think in their minds, like American, it, sort of in the same way that for us, Russian, we are like introduction to them is sort of as the bad guy in any action film. And of course, coming off of like the second half of the 20th century and the Red Scare and communist fear and all that kind of stuff and Cold War stuff, you know, there's a lot of latent stigma on our side. And then you get there and you realize, oh, this was a two-sided thing. Of course, they have their preconceived notions and their assumptions. And for them, the vision of the American is that kind of like corn-fed, Iowa, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, sort of. It's certainly a white presentation. It's definitely a masculine presentation. Mm-hmm. And they have their own stigmas with it. But it's definitely not a gay Black kid. You know, that's not what they're expecting.
Right, right. I mean, they also have their own governmental issues with homosexuality. And a lot of my queer friends over there... when I was over there, the underground scene was really thriving. Like, they were proudly out. But it was almost this, like... It wasn't like on the streets out. It was like nightlife, or it was like something else. You know, it was this weird middle ground. But even me, when I told people that I was going to Russia, the majority of people were like, "Why would you ever go to Russia? Like, why?"
Yeah.
And so we both have these preconceived—not we, but like both countries have these preconceived notions of each other that I think are a little archaic, to be honest. But
yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I would love to go to Russia. I'm just too lazy to do the visa process. Sorry.
That's why the visa was a whole thing. Yeah.
The visa was a whole thing. My best friend lived there at the time. And so she helped me a lot getting everything together, to be honest.
Yeah.
Told me where to send it or whatever. Like, she translated stuff for me. So that really helped. But it was a process. Mm-hmm. It was a process.
It's really hard.
Yeah. Okay. We talked about Russia. We talked about your early beginnings. But when we come back, let's talk about some recent things. So we'll be right back.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
the war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and we're back with Clark Moore. So we touched on you going to Russia. Your diplomat dream was averted quickly after taking government class. But when did you know that you were interested in performing?
That was always the dream. That was kind of like from the beginning. I started acting when I was 7 in Atlanta. And in fact, at any moment, I was ready to abandon school altogether. I was like begging my parents to move to New York or to Los Angeles. I had friends who were also child actors and were booking big gigs or like flying out to LA for pilot season, you know, for a couple of months mm-hmm. or whatever. And my parents, I think the line in the sand that they drew was very clearly, we'll support you, we'll make space for anything that we can do locally. We're not going to uproot our lives. We're certainly not going to create a power dynamic or like a financial dynamic wherein we are dependent on your income, you know? Mm-hmm. So things would happen. Like I got very far in the callbacks for Young Simba on Broadway. And my parents were like, and sort of got invited to New York, as I remember it. And my parents were very much like, this is an accomplishment in and of itself. And that's about where the accomplishment is going to end because we're not moving to Broadway. There's no one that can live with you in New York. We're not like homeschooling you or, you know, any of that. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's kind of always been this thing that I've needed and that I've wanted to do. And it's just sort of been like a very slow and steady climb from one step to the next. And when I track my progress over a graph, it's like very truly mm-hmm. like year over year, one step at a time, as opposed to the exponential growth that, you know, we all pray for.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you had very similar parents to ours who are like, mm-hmm. get a degree that yeah. can pay the bills and no, we're not going to uproot our lives for you to do mm-hmm. anything. You just yeah. got to figure it out as you go.
Yeah. Very practical.
Yeah. Very practical. Yeah.
And I do feel like that is like, person of color parent is not impressed. You know what mm-mm. I mean? Like, they're not like, I'm glad. Like, they're like, we're so glad you found this calling, but figure it out on your own time and don't yeah. ask us to pay a bunch of money for you yeah. to do something, even though you're like under 18. You know, like, it's all like,
100%.
Figure, like, my dad, my whole life, I'd be like, we should live in LA because I want to be a filmmaker or whatever. You know, I'd always be like, I need this camera. And my dad would be like, that's great. But no.
Yeah, same. I was like, I wanted all these cameras. I wanted to make little things that, I don't know, but they were just like, oh, that's cute, sweetie.
But even after college, like I was like, I want to move to LA. My dad's like, that's fine. You can move to LA, but you have to pay your own rent if you move to LA. And then I was like, why can't I, you know, I was like, why don't I have any nepotism?
Right. I dream of nepotism every day. I can't wait for them to like finally reveal that they've been hiding a trust fund from me all these years. But I also feel like they, so much of it comes from, at least from my parents, this awareness that the, you know, life for people of color, life for Black people. I mean, in general, it isn't fair. You know, the concept of like life isn't fair is obviously something we all learn very quickly as when we're young. Anyone who watched The Lion King, bring that reference back around.
Yeah.
But I think for them, especially with regard to people of color in entertainment, you know, I think they were like, we know plenty of people in our lives, in our family, in, you know, who we grew up with or whatever, who had these dreams and who had the talent, you know, were certainly 10 times better than the white people who were working over and over and over and over again because there were roles for them. But at the end of the day, if no one writes a role for you, you can be the best actor in the world. You're not going to have a job. And I think for them, it wasn't so much like, in order for you to get work, you need to be a better actor. You need to be like diving into your craft. For them, it was like, we have no concept of how you'll even build, certainly as an openly gay Black actor, how you'll build a career for yourself. And you certainly may get these moments or these flashpoints, but how does one create longevity, stability? How do I, you know, support a family, buy a home? Like all of these things that are the narrative that are of success for them, like what it looks like, the milestones. I mean, and speaking to them being unimpressed, like celebrity to them is not at all interesting. It's almost like a fun fact, not a like character trait or a quality, and certainly not anything to aspire to. And they'll see me on TV and they'll call and be like, oh, hey, I just saw you on TV. Just wanted to check. Like, do you have money to pay rent next month? Like, okay, you saw me on TV. Can you say congratulations?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like their minds aren't there at all. They're very like, yeah, you're famous to some people, but can you eat?
Like, were you paid to do that?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're on the news. Did they pay you well? Like, yeah.
Right.
So my running joke is if I ever came home with an Oscar, my dad will be like, well, do they supply health insurance?
Yeah.
You're like, well, what is this statue? Like, what does this mean? Like, can you pay? Like, it really would be like, well, can you afford to, like, pay your mortgage? Like, do you have health insurance? What if you get in an accident tomorrow? That statue doesn't mean anything. And you're like, oh, my gosh.
Can you write that off on your taxes? Like, I don't know, man.
There's something really nice about as we continue to have success in this industry, we start to realize that, oh, right, the Oscar actually doesn't mean anything. You know, like there is certainly something admirable about it, or it's nice to, for your work to be recognized. But anyone who's won any award, and I'm sort of foreshadowing because, Shireen, you mentioned the Human Rights Campaign Award speech. Anyone who's sort of gotten a recognition of any kind realizes like, oh, that did not feel like what I imagined it felt like for those people that I was sitting in my room watching on television.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I think that's true. Yeah. I do think our parents, it's like a mixture of like fear for us, but also like security. I think they just like, especially for me and Anna, like our parents are immigrants and like they don't understand, like they just want to make sure that we're living in this country like the way we're supposed to live, you know, like making it as easy for us as possible. But I do think that's interesting that you brought up the speech that you gave, because I also think like awards are a kind of hack, but for a different reason. Like especially when it comes to like Oscars, Golden Globes, any of the film awards, acting awards, they're all built and also completely controlled by like white cis men. So it almost feels like silly to like want that validation constantly for me or like for anybody. Like, why are we killing ourselves to get this validation from people that don't even fucking care about us?
And of course, the secret that nobody, you know, for people who, listeners who don't know, all of those award shows require the artists to self-submit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like, you know, I did not realize that when I was watching the Oscars
growing up. I didn't realize
it
either, yeah.
I thought this Academy was plucking people truly out of just like the entirety of whatever was produced that year. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was that you have to have a team that you pay to campaign in a certain way and that you have to submit in a certain way under certain categories for certain reasons. Like, I mean, to say that it's political is such a cliche, but like, that there is a logistical element to it beyond just, it's certainly not an altruistic or like beyond like the cis white male element of it. It's definitely not a meritocracy.
No.
There's so many layers to those systems.
It's elitist. It's convoluted for a reason, like on purpose almost, because it's so elitist. And it's depressing to me that it's not even like wanting that validation from an institution, but like we almost kind of need it, you know, like we almost need that leg up to even get anywhere, or else like no one takes you seriously or something, or like, I don't know. That's a whole nother story.
A good example of that, which this past Oscars, which I found very interesting, was that for Judas and the Black Messiah, they submitted Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield both as supporting actors because, I mean, what I read online was that they were trying to leave the best actor role, hopefully, that Chadwick Boseman would have won.
Right.
But then, like, that, there's so much going on that you're like, that's not even fair because, I mean, I would love for Chadwick have won. In case you don't know, Anthony Hopkins won, and they wouldn't even let Anthony Hopkins zoom in. Whole thing.
I mean, no, he was asleep. He was asleep. It came out that he was asleep during the ceremony in like
Norway. But apparently he did ask
he
to zoom in and they told him no because Steven Soderbergh said no zooming for this one. He wanted zero zoom screens for this because he's over it and whatever.
But like, just to show you, like, he didn't know he was, like, to the point where he was sleeping through the thing.
Yeah.
And it was just the most weird anticlimactic ending. Like, they purposely switched the best picture with the best actor for being last. So it was almost like, oh, they're going to end on this, like,
they didn't even give Chloe Zhao her, like, last end movie No Man Land win. That was strange. But I was like, it's just not fair that, like, you know, like, Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield are both supporting actors in a movie they starred in.
Yeah.
It's all politics. It's like you just have to try and work the system so your actors can get recognized. And it's like, it shouldn't work that way, you know?
No.
So I kind of feel like, you know, this is the time where we're looking at all these structures and all of these things that we've just taken as assumptions in our lives. And we're saying, like, does that make sense? Do we really want to... Do we really want to work in that way? I saw a couple of people on the internet talking about, LOL, like the darkest way to start any comment or any story. On the internet, they were saying.
Right. I read this tweet.
Literally. Yeah. But someone was talking about how their response to the Oscars, they didn't even expect this emotion, but in a time where we're all having to like come together, it felt so weird and anachronistic to be competing for, you know, like, why are we've always sort of wondered, like, why are we competing in this way? Arts are not sports, and there doesn't need to be one winner. Like, is there a way to celebrate, not in like a participation trophy kind of way, but like, is there a way to celebrate people without it having to mean that everyone else loses?
I 100% agree. It's like uplifting versus like, having to be chosen as the ultimate winner. Like, I just, especially with people choosing that, aren't going to be like, they're just, like, it's implicit. Like, a white man that watches any other story from a person of color versus a white story, he will by default relate more to the white story. Like, you can be as intelligent and unbiased as possible, which I don't think the majority of them are. But but my whole point is, like, why are we pitting against each other rather than appreciating the art for what it is? Like, that's what art's supposed to be. It's supposed to, like, I don't know, be expression and uplift and all this stuff, but it just becomes convoluted in this obsession to be, like, number one. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. For, like, the Academy.
Right. And everyone gets so emotional up there, and I'm just like, shut up. Like, I know for people of color, I understand completely why they would get emotional, but, like, for a white person getting, like, their seventh Oscar, I'm just like, don't, like, you know why you're here. Like, yeah, just get off the stage.
That's why they keep giving it to Frances McDormand, because she's like, hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Like, her reaction was very fitting to me, being like, okay, I get it. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. Right. Right.
But
yeah, yeah, I kind of wish that I hope we can move it to, I still, of course, like, have such reverence for these institutions, because they sometimes, you know, turn me on to projects that I've not heard of, or, you know, my sort of feeling about it all is like, I would love for it to shift from what we thought it was, the most important, the end all be all, the, we've also heard every story, every time someone wins an Oscar, they say the year after that was the worst year of their career. You know, like,
interesting.
After you won the ultimate prize, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And how do you pick a job? How do you, you know, like, all of a sudden everything is being evaluated in the context of Academy Award winner, mm-hmm. fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And some people don't get any offers because everyone assumes, oh, everyone's going to offer them everything. And so then the next few years, they don't work at all. Like, yeah. It really is this, like, strange, I don't even know how to describe it, but it doesn't quite have the effect that you think it's going to have on your career, it seems.
Right.
And so I hope we can move it to a place where it's a nice anecdote. It's a nice, you know, oh, cool. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's a thing that happened. That's a thing that I got, you know, as opposed to feeling like it has to be the defining moment in our careers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, maybe I was shitting on the Oscars too much. I think my biggest issue with them is that art is just subjective to me. Like, mm-hmm. books are subjective. Like, I just don't appreciate someone telling me that something is the best because it's their opinion. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's my biggest issue, I think, with award shows in general. I'm just like, unless it's like voted or something or whatever, but even then I'm just like, hack. But I apologize for shitting on the Oscars, everyone that likes them out there. I have so many friends that like them. I don't understand why, but I won't yuck your yum any further. I do want to ask about the human rights campaign speech. I thought it was very uplifting and beautiful, and I'm just so glad you had the platform to say those words to an audience. But what was you brought it up earlier, like, it's not all that it's cracked up to be. What do you mean by that?
So I was sitting in my house with no air conditioning. We had just wrapped Crazy Ex-Girlfriend maybe 3 or 4 months prior. March of 2019 was our last day. And so it was sort of, I guess, you know, in response to Love, Simon and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, but I had nothing else on the calendar. I had no work ahead of me. And in fact, I would go on to not work for 2 years. In fact, I'm going to Big Bear this weekend for the next 2 weeks to shoot a movie. And that's my first job since Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And I got it on my birthday, March 15th, 2021. And the last day of work on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was March 15th, 2019. And so the reason why I bring that up is because, you know, in terms of how we define success and how we experience success, that award came at a time where I did not feel successful at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I had other cast members who were going on, who were doing pilots, some of which have gone and some of which haven't, but still, like, had prospects, had things in the works. And I was kind of looking into the expanse, and like, I had made money on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, sure, but like, not enough to last me forever and not enough to like be comfortable. And, you know, and so it was this weird, it required me to look at myself and see the elements of my life that I was attaching to external validation, the points in my of happiness where I was like, if only I had a job, if only I had a TV show, if only I had, if only someone would buy the show that I'm pitching all around town, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then this award came in and I was just like, well, I almost didn't accept it because I said to my manager, I was like, is this too soon?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how do I receive an award for my contribution? I haven't contributed yet. You know, it was a lot of imposter syndrome. Anyway, ultimately the lesson was, if you're looking for external validation to give you internal completion or internal wholeness, you're never going to be happy. It's there's never going to be enough to fill the yawning chasm inside.
Wow. I love that. The yawning chasm.
Yeah, you can borrow it.
No, you're describing my insides. Yeah. I'm glad that you ended up taking the gig, I think, or not the gig, but like you ended up accepting the award because your speech, well, it's about visibility. It's about continuing to exist, like, and being, and how your visibility is a privilege. Mm-hmm. And I do think that message is so important. Even mm-hmm. just you being on a stage in front of a mic, that's visibility in and of itself. So if someone sees that, that's already like an achievement. And I'm really grateful that you decided to do it because it's significant in a different way.
What I realized, the performance is for the audience, not for us. You know, when you're doing a play, you're creating magic on stage. But as the magician, you know the secrets. You know that there's no back to the wall. You know that the, you know, the pyrotechnics are coming in 30 seconds. Like, whatever the things are that make that experience so magical for the viewer, you're never going to have that as the one creating the magic. And so I just had to put my career into that context as well. You know, I didn't feel deserving of that award, but the people who gave it to me felt I was. And so I felt like I needed to honor and make space for that, exactly as you said. I didn't need to feel worthy of the award. It wasn't really for me. It was for them. You know, it was a gift that they were able to give me in exchange for the gifts that they felt that I gave them in the form of my work. That's the only way I was able to make sense of it.
Sometimes it's like even just the smallest notion of just like, you know what, at times you just have to let go of that imposter syndrome and just kind of literally just go with it, because like you don't know, like it's hard to see outside yourself. And Trina and I have that problem all the time where we're like, who listens to this podcast or whatever. But sometimes you just have to be like, well, I may feel like my contribution is little, but like I shouldn't dismiss the fact that it could matter to just any random person. Like as long as, you know, we are able to make one person feel less alone in the world, then it's like, well, then I feel like maybe I have accomplished something, because I don't want anyone to ever feel like how me and Shireen felt growing up when there was zero representation of Middle Eastern women on TV or anywhere. And it's like, well, now we have a podcast. Maybe they'll be like, oh, look at these brown girls also just like having fun outside of like the standards of what we're all kind of culturally forced to understand growing up and breaking free from that. And it's like, if one person goes like, well, okay, that makes me feel a little better because I don't necessarily feel what my parents feel or what my family feels, or I don't fit in with, you know, other Middle Eastern or, you know, just like Persian or Arab or, you know, Indian girls, then it's like, cool.
Yeah.
That's that little thing. Yeah. You're like, good. I'm glad I could help in that one instance.
Even just the one person matters. Yeah. Like, it's like your existence by itself is helping. Like, your existence in the public is helping by itself. Like, that, there have been, I mean, basically every film I've ever made I've hated, but every time I release it, I'm just like, get it over with, cringe, it's out there. I always get like a handful of responses that like make me cry, being like, this helped me in XYZ way. And I'm just like, oh, this is why it matters. It's like a reminder of why we make anything, why we make art at all. It's like, even if we have this deep-rooted imposter syndrome or self-doubt or anything, especially as people of marginalized communities, I think our existence in and of itself is like a form of activism in a way, like even without trying. And I sometimes that's a burden, because that means we have this task of educating people. But I think if we can glean the positives, we can hopefully make people feel not alone, like Anna said.
Yeah. For, you know, to give the listener a taste of, I mean, this whole vibe, this is just my vibe. This is like the kind of conversations I have in my life. And so you're sort of getting a taste of what the podcast is. But one of the things is something that one of my therapists, an old therapist, said to me, which really like cracked my understanding of myself wide open. I have always had this awareness of narcissism as an actor, as a performer, as a person who's constantly having to engage with ego and self. You know, you have to have some level of narcissism to believe that you're worthy of attention, of being in a movie, of receiving an award. It can be the thing that protects you from, you know, the like crippling self-doubt. But I didn't realize until she told me that the other end of the narcissistic spectrum isn't someone who is like completely oblivious to self. Like, it's still narcissistic to be self-deprecating. It's still narcissistic to be overly humble. You see what I'm saying? Like, I thought the opposite of narcissism was, oh, I'm not good enough for that.
Like selflessness.
I don't deserve that. I don't like whatever. But that is just another version of engaging with ego.
Right.
You know, sort of like I'm not worthy of this award is just as much diving into the narcissism and the elevation of self as I am worthy of every award.
Right.
And once I realized that was the opposite side of the same coin rather than the opposite end of the spectrum, I was able to be like, oh, okay, so the goal isn't to be as far away from the person who's egotistical and obsessed with themselves as possible to the point of self-deprecating, to the point of like self-flagellation. The goal is to be in the middle. Mm-hmm. The goal is to be, I'm neither the best nor the worst. You know, I just am. I'm
you
just
exist.
Here.
Yes. You just exist. That's my whole goal. I just want to simply exist.
Yeah.
Let's take our second break. We'll be right back. We'll talk more about your podcast and all that good stuff. So don't go anywhere.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and we're back.
We're back. Yeah, let's talk a little about Soul Bomb. Give us a little background on what Soul Bomb is and like why you decided to start this show.
Yeah, Soul Bomb is a podcast. I always say it's about healing and identity. So I found myself having these conversations with friends throughout my life. And I actually had a podcast a couple of years ago when I first moved out here that was literally just me chatting one-on-one with a friend and kind of like comparing notes is what I like to say. Like, are you feeling this as well? How are you dealing with this? How are you dealing with like stress and taxes and, you know, like rent. And with Soul Bomb specifically, I realized that these conversations, because we started developing it far before we launched. I think we were developing it for like a year and a half, almost 2 years. And part of that was like, I got sucked into Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and was busy and just didn't really have time. But then it kept coming back around, this idea of like, I really want to feel connected to people and I want to walk through their journeys with them. And then the summer happened last summer and all of the craziness. And it really helped focus what we were trying to accomplish because I was like, what is the angle? It is an interview podcast. You know, it's mostly personal histories, very similar to these kinds of conversations, very casual, very like, we talk about life, we talk about love, we talk about whatever the guest wants to talk about. But over the summer, I realized there was this sort of like 2 to 3 week period, you'll remember, right after George Floyd was murdered. And any person who is sent left of center, your entire news feed, your entire Instagram feed, like everything you looked at was about race. It was about anti-racism. It was about these are the books you need to read. These are the voices you need to listen to. These are the things we shouldn't be doing. I mean, it was so loud. And I remember a day when I was just scrolling endlessly through my feed and every single post was hashtag Black Lives Matter. And I had this awareness at the time that this moment that was so exciting and charged, where it felt like change really could happen for the first time ever, maybe, that it wouldn't last, first of all, mm-hmm. that we would have, our news feeds would go back to, and they did, after like 2 or 3 weeks, it started to come back to like, hashtag grateful, or like, right. This is the project yeah. that I'm promoting now, or like, I'm on vacation now. And so I knew we wouldn't be able to like, maintain that work, but I also knew it was going to continue in the background. And I had this question of how are we going to take care of ourselves while we do this work for the next 6 months, 6 years, for the rest of our lives, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then the show took on this healing lens of like, what are you doing to take care of yourself? Not just in the pandemic, not just in the context of Black Lives Matter protests. What are you doing to take care of yourself in general? What were you mm-hmm. doing to take care of yourself before? How are you going to bring those practices into your daily life moving forward? What works for you? What doesn't work for you? You know, there's sort of like a practical element to it as well. And it's been like great.
That. Yeah.
I got to start listening.
Yeah, please. It's such a blast.
I subscribed, but I haven't started listening yet. But now I have to.
Now.
The subscription helps as well, as you know.
Yeah exactly. But these kinds of conversations are so not only important, but like they're so therapeutic, you know? Yeah. And I think even if someone isn't ready to have the conversation as a listener, I think hearing people have that conversation is helpful, whatever it's about. And I like that you kind of give an open door to the guest being like, what do you want to talk about? That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sort of, you know, like I have an idea of what I want to get at and sort of like, a reason for being mm-hmm. there. But similarly, I'm very like, if there's anything that's off limits, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm not mm-hmm. here to like, you know, get a headline.
Yeah.
I'm really here to just kind of like process together. It's really about yeah. being in community in that way. And I think, you know, the other big takeaway from conversations about race, especially, and conversations about identity, is that they are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Like, how do we learn how to be uncomfortable together? How do we learn how to talk about things? And I step in it all the time. I put my foot in my mouth all the time or say something that I'm like, oh, I didn't mean to offend you in that way. Or, you know, like, I am not by any means a teacher. I am a student here mm-hmm. with you. And that's fine. Let's make mistakes together and let's get canceled together. You know, like, whatever we got to do along the way. Like, I'm interested in people who have questions, not people who have answers.
I like that.
Yeah. I feel like we try and do that too. But you seem like you've got it all figured out.
Already too.
You like seem that's like not fair, man.
You should be new to the game. you've got to figure it out. Where have we been?
Then I have you fooled.
Yeah.
The magic is working.
Yeah. You just seem so much more self-actualized than us. But the ego versus like, or engaging with your ego, even when you're like overly humbled. That's actually a very interesting concept. While you were describing mm-hmm. that, I was like,
yeah, I'm going to be thinking about that for a while. Because both involve some degree of being consumed with yourself, you know, and being either consumed with your greatness or be consumed with your failures. And I think both are so debilitating and dangerous in their own ways. And they're both so isolating, first of all. Like, both of them are very isolating. Recently, I've been watching these YouTube videos. I'm like trying to learn more about the specifics of personality disorders and mental disorders because that's kind of stuff fascinates me. And so I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos about narcissism, about borderline, about all these different things that kind of get misdiagnosed a lot and all this other stuff. And it's fascinating because there's so much overlap to just so many different feelings. And there's something just so human about just like coming out and just like saying all these things out loud. That something that your podcast probably does that I appreciate is like just not skirting around anything. Like, we should talk about this. It shouldn't be taboo to say psych ward or like whatever these words are that trigger something in people. And I'm talking about mental health just because it's on my mind right now. But I think opening up the door to have conversations like that very naturally and normally is so, so important. Right. And I was on Behind the Bastards last year, and I talked about sexuality and like orgasms and all this stuff like very candidly. And I hadn't really done that on a podcast before. And that podcast has a lot of people listening to it. And it was terrifying. But what I learned from that experience is that I'm okay if I have to normalize subjects that are hard to talk about by putting myself in the center. I'm okay with that because I'm learning too. And if that's the only way people are going to talk about it, fine. Use me. It's fine. So yeah. I think we're all kind of conduits for your important conversations, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And you know, you were talking about both ends of I'm so good or I'm so bad being about being consumed with yourself. That's sort of what I'm getting at with the Oscars not being real, you know, awards not being real, celebrity fame not being real. It is, you know, the award is an award. And there was work that you did that people resonated with enough, as well as all the other pieces that came together for you to be on that stage. You know, you certainly are deserving of it in a way, but it isn't the only thing. It isn't the most real. It certainly isn't more real than the mundanity in your life or the banal elements that you want to, you know, like, I think a lot of us, especially getting into entertainment, want ideally for the glamour to mundanity ratio to sort of like shift heavily in favor of glamour in this theory that like that would be the real life. That would be me experiencing success. That would be me like doing it.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's like, I mean, whatever reality is, it's sitting in all of the experiences and allowing that peak to just be that, a peak. And the valley as well to just be that. And to recognize that you're going to continue moving through all moments of that spectrum, constantly in and out. None are more real than the others.
I need to remember this. Nothing is more real than anything else. Everything is just your life and the moments happening in it. And I think that's so important to remember, just like not to be chasing something, but just actually realizing it's all the same. You know?
I do want to say, speaking to, you know, feeling self-actualized, it is the practice. Like that is to be the annoying person that talks about, quote, doing the work. Like that is the work that we're talking about. It's like when you get triggered by something. Earlier today, I had a series of things that happened in the lead up to this call that were not what I wanted them to be. And I had to acknowledge those things. I had to accept those things. I meditated for 10 minutes and allowed that to kind of like smooth out the rough edges. I want to be honest to the listener. I didn't feel great after meditating. I didn't feel like, and now everything's solved. I took my magical pill, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, but I did feel better. I felt marginally better. I was able to let go of those things. Actually, I can tell you what those things were because I feel like maybe that's a good example.
Yeah.
So I went to go get a coffee. And I just wanted to pick me up before speaking with y'all because I was having a little bit of an afternoon dip. And I parked on the side street and wasn't really paying attention. Went in. As I was in line, the guy ahead of me bought my coffee for me, surprised me, bought me a free latte. And I was like, oh my God, the universe is taking care of me. There are good people in the world. And I go back to my car and realize I had forgotten to pay the meter and had gotten a parking ticket. So my free latte had gone from $0 to $63.
Yeah. Right.
And in the drive from my coffee shop back to here, the narrative that was playing in my head was like, see, you can never have anything good without yeah. then having something bad to balance it out. You know, mm-hmm. like this is your life. You'll never only be the person who got the free latte. You'll always be the person who had to have the asterisk next to the free latte of the mm-hmm. $63 parking ticket. And I was allowing myself to kind of go on that journey for a bit. And then I realized, like, I also could have paid the meter, you know? Yeah. I could have parked literally 100 feet back where it was free parking.
Yeah.
You know, I could have been more aware of my surroundings as opposed to just, like, bopping around, oblivious, blissful. You know, it wasn't the universe balancing out a gift. It was me not paying attention, not being conscious and present in that moment. And then coincidentally happening to be in mm-hmm. the coffee shop in the time when the guy drove by to give me the ticket, you know?
Yeah,
like,
right.
It doesn't always have to be the narrative, like affirming the narrative of your life, unless you want it to be. And I chose not to let it be. And so I paid the ticket. I meditated. It's now in my past. You know, it's a reminder to, would I have liked to keep that $63? Absolutely. Do I have $63 to be wasting in that way? No.
Yeah.
But it's a reminder and I can try to be more conscious next time.
Yeah. I think that's what meditation really helps me is be more mindful. Mm-hmm. Like that's the biggest takeaway is just being more mindful. I get road rage sometimes. And recently after I've been meditating more consistently, I'm just like, they're just having a day. Like, it's okay. You don't have to let it affect you. Like, I have a very bad temper. Mm-hmm. I just had some car issues right before we started recording, and I was mad. I was so mad. And I was, like, slamming things. Like, I get really mad and just, like, about to blow. And I had to just, like, take some deep breaths and, like, no more angry crying. You know, mm-hmm. it's just being more mindful. And, like, honestly, what you said about balancing, I feel like I understand that pretty well. Like, even if something good is happening, I'm like, what's the other part of it? Like, I'm going to mm-hmm. turn the corner and realize I'm not this lucky, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that you were honest about that because I think it's very relatable.
Yeah. And in that way, those two events can now be separate. I mm-hmm. got a free latte. I did. Mm-hmm. And that was a gift. And that is separate from the ticket that I got.
Yeah.
I do that too, where I'm like, the universe just doesn't want me to succeed. Things mm-hmm. where I'm like, it's absurd that I just thought that, but I'm now rolling with this thought. And it's sometimes hard for me to accept. It's like, no, you're also just not being very present in something mm-hmm. that happened. Or you're just like, you're being flippant about how you're taking care of something. Or mm-hmm. My anger comes in a lot of like weird ways of like feeling very, very like I my favorite line is I was not brought to this world to have any luck. Like I just have no luck at all. Like nothing yeah. works out for me. Everything I've ever gotten, I've had to go through like blood, sweat, and tears, you know?
Right.
And I struggle with that a lot. And therapy has always been like, it's not luck. Like you just need to be more, like you just need to pay, like just focus just a little more yeah. and something won't break or like, and I'm like, duh. Why can't it just be easy? mm-hmm.
But those self-narratives are so pervasive because I feel the same way. I was born on April Fool's Day and literally my narrative since I was like old enough to realize how unlucky that, in quotes, unlucky that is, I'm just like, oh, my life's a joke. Like, that was my thing. I was like, my life's a fucking joke. Of course this would happen to me. Of course I would fall down two flights of stairs. My life's a joke.
Right.
Not realizing like you don't have to fulfill these prophecies because you believe that your yeah. life is a joke or that nothing good happens to you. I don't know. I think it's our mind is more stronger than we give it credit for in very subtle ways. Mm-hmm. Like I always thought it was funny. I always used humor to like, I don't know, deflect or cope. So when I was saying my life was a joke, there was a level of humor to it, but I honestly believed it too.
mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, and even now I could say it and actually believe it too, but I have to realize like, this is not a healthy way to think about your life or yourself.
Mm.
Yeah, but
yeah, I mean, it's who's writing your narrative if not you? You know, mm-hmm. you are the, I think a lot of these things are, I was thinking as you were saying on about luck, a lot of this is wanting something else to just sort of like appear or mm-hmm. like for the magic of the universe to work in our favor, so to speak. When in reality, in order to feel lucky, or in order to feel like your life isn't a joke, change the definition of what you think lucky means. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be lucky? You know, like when you make a list of the successes and the things that have worked out, even though they required hard work, I imagine there are many things that you've worked hard for that haven't worked out. Mm-hmm. You know, like for me, the equation hasn't always been a direct, what is that, like a input output of mm-hmm. the amount of work I put in is equal to the amount of success I get out of it.
Yeah.
There's always some sort of magic that happens in that computation that I can't control. And sometimes the things I didn't work as hard on work out really, really well. And the some things that are like my blood, sweat, and tears just never come to fruition. And so if you are writing the story that my life is a joke, then it will always be a joke because right. every time something happens, you will contextualize it within that narrative. And so that's sort of like the thing that I'm constantly working against is like, how, okay, do not let the narrative write itself on autopilot. Come in, be active in this narrative, be active in this process. That doesn't mean the feelings are going to necessarily go away. That doesn't mean I'm going to like not still feel shitty about the fact that I got a ticket for no reason.
Yeah.
But like it doesn't necessarily have to be who I am. It doesn't have to be connected to my identity unless I choose to connect it to my identity. And that's ego. Eckhart Tolle would call that ego. Putting my identity into the hands of the ticket person who gave me the ticket is ego.
Wow. I understand why you have a podcast now. This was just like a big therapy session.
Fully unqualified. I have no degrees in psychology. Please, you know, speak to a licensed therapist.
But podcasting is a little bit therapeutic, as I said. And I'm glad you have a podcast because you are very good at unpacking these things and letting people unpack them with you. So I'm excited for your podcast to keep growing.
Thank you. Yeah, fingers crossed. It's hard out here, as y'all know.
Yeah.
It's a crazy, crazy market right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, and to further Shireen's point, I feel like half of it is just saying these things out loud. Like, I don't think I've ever said that luck thing out loud.
I don't think I said the joke thing out loud ever. I've believed it the whole time.
Yeah. I just, yeah.
But Anna, Anna, I only said it because you said yours. You know?
Yeah.
Vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for truly, yes. This has been an amazing episode to just like sit in. Just like listening to you. Sometimes I would forget. Like I was like, I'm hosting. But it's
there
just
are so
been,
many
like,
things that I'm gonna think about that you talked about.
Thank y'all for having me. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Where can people like continue to follow you, find you, find the podcast? Please pitch yourself to us, baby.
Yeah. I'm at Mr. Clark Moore on all the platforms. And the podcast is Soul Balm by Clark Moore, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts, as they say in the biz.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We're everywhere.
You sound like a natural.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, rate and review. What are some of the other things?
Subscribe. Rate and review.
Oh, I hear that we're supposed to shift to saying follow rather than subscribe. Apple Podcasts is changing the language.
Okay.
To follow.
All right. Follow.
I subscribe to a couple of podcast newsletters. Don't ask me why. It's a dark space.
I think it's cute.
Yeah, I'm trying to be a good student.
Yeah.
Follow. Okay. Follow. Yeah. Follow all our shows. Follow all of Clark's shows.
Yes,
and,
please.
And until next time, just listen to Soul Balm. It's Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically Ambed, AMB on Twitter, Ethnically Ambig, AMBIG on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's ShiroHero666 on Twitter and just ShiroHero on Instagram.
And I'm just at InHosting on Twitter. Yeah. So, now go listen to Soul Balm right now.
ASAP.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating.
I got a big heart, and I'm very forgiving, but like, don't abuse it. It's been abused enough.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star starting May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.